the voice of a changing world, Chris Smith, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Mike has sent me a message on the chat box, which you can find on tntradio.live. And he has said, Dai Lee, who is the federal member for Fowler, who said that we shouldn't be declaring it a terrorist act, despite the fact that the guy has some kind of form supporting extreme Islam. And he yelled Allah Akbar when he decided to stab the bishop and also the priest, and then smiled and smirked about it. Dai Lee says, Mike must stop cancelling the truth. She's a silly girl. I think she's blotted a copybook. I thought she was doing very, very well as a federal member, and she was an independent that someone could trust and have faith in, but this is garbage. Why are we not telling the truth because we're worried that others will be ignited? Well, that's the job of the police to keep under control. It's not the job of telling lies to ensure that people don't act criminally. Bizarre statement. I want to get back to what occurred at that Assyrian church, and I want to get back to the stabbing just for a second, because The Australian, a short time ago, has published part of the sermon that the bishop was giving prior to that 16-year-old allegedly stabbing him. The high-profile Assyrian Christian Orthodox leader, stabbed during a live stream of his service, has in the past vocally proclaimed support for Palestinian civilians and criticised Israel's actions in Gaza. Now, if you had just read that, you'd think to yourself, well, why would someone who was an Islamic extremist, supposedly, why would he want to stab someone who supported the Palestinian plight and got stuck into Israel? Seems bizarre. But then if you go on with the story and start to see what they have plucked from other sermons, you then get a picture that may have explained why he was a target. Because he also said, the bishop, he had a question mark with Islam. As authorities scramble, of course, to investigate the motive, Bishop Mari Emanuel has questioned the validity of other faiths, including in particularly Islam, but said that he was and has love and respect for Muslims. His views, religious leaders explained, were a conservative Orthodox reading of Christianity, that only Jesus Christ of Nazareth was the way to heaven, which alongside all different faith views should be tolerated and accepted in Australia. He has, however, taken aim at the Islamic faith. The identity, ethnicity, or religion of the alleged attacker has not been confirmed by authorities. Can I just say that may explain why he was targeted, but it doesn't say that the targeted attack was in any way valid. He can say what he wants about other religions. It's a free country where we can express free speech, and that includes criticizing even other religions, if we want to. Now, the fact that he said what he said should not mean that he needs to be the victim of a stabbing incident, because we do profess free speech in this country, and that includes saying it from the pulpit. I want to take you to the Epoch Times that has got an update on COVID vaccine boosters that I thought was really interesting. Now, the Epoch Times does a great job keeping up with the various studies that have been distributed and released since the pandemic, some of which have proven exactly the opposite to what we were told during the pandemic. But this one's an interesting one. Getting a COVID-19 booster shot at its timing may affect the frequency and type of symptoms in COVID infections. A recently published study in Vaccines found that boosted individuals were significantly more likely to get nasal congestion and/or a sore throat, but considerably less likely to experience body and muscle aches compared with those who were vaccinated but had not received a booster dose during the Omicron surge. Very interesting. Additionally, the frequency of fever and cough symptoms was directly associated with increased time between vaccine doses. With each booster vaccination, the likelihood of having a fever and a cough increased by 4.4% and 4.8% respectively. So in other words, whatever you have been told by doctors who are only told by the big pharma how these vaccines work, are completely and utterly to be ignored, because they don't know. given some of the studies we're seeing and how the vaccines operate and the side effects being far more observed than expected, which we know has been revealed by the New Zealand bunch of scientists, well, we know that what we were told was bullshit. And we know that what Big Pharma was telling everyone was BS as well. I'm glad the Epoch Times is keeping across all of this, because bit by bit, study by study, research by research, it just proves that what we were told by health officials and politicians during the pandemic was wrong. And the so-called conspiracists have been proven utterly correct. This is TNT.
Connecting the dots, painting the bigger picture.
They always have great conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, I want to get to this. While the world's global attention has been focusing on Eastern Europe, it's been focusing on the Middle East almost every day. What is China up to? What's going on in the Indo-Pacific that we're missing? What's China doing that may have an impact on their Indo-Pacific neighbours? And for that matter, every country in Asia? Well, the answer is lots. They're never, ever static, the China Communist Party. And these moves have enormous repercussions for nations such as the Solomon Islands and Singapore, et cetera, et cetera. That's the way China would see it anyway. Asian expert Andrew Phelan joins us on the program. Now, Andrew was one of four graduates chosen nationally in the early 90s for the then Australia-China Council postgraduate scholarship. He's a graduate of the John Hopkins Nanjing University Center for Chinese and American Studies and has commercial experience spanning 25 years across China and pretty much all of Asia. Andrew Phelan, welcome to TNT.
Good to be with you, Chris.
Thank you very much for your time. I want to start in the Solomon Islands because we haven't heard too much about the Solomon Islands, but we do know that China now has a series of agreements with the Solomon Islands. We know that they have a very significant influence, maybe even more of an influence or close to as Australia nowadays. It took a very long time for the President Sogavare to allow the voters of the Solomon Islands to have a say. The last election was 5 years ago. But of course, the archipelago nation goes to the polls tomorrow. That crept up on us. All the campaigning ceased yesterday. I wonder whether these elections can be described as fair elections, given the influence of China nowadays.
It's a great point, Chris. To just refer to your comment that you made earlier on in terms of looking at fields far away, you'd think that Australia, of all countries, after Gallipoli and World War One, would have learned our lessons. But it's the hill that I'm going to die on is trying to get more attention for Asia and our media. So thanks again for having me to discuss this. You're right, the elections are tomorrow. And just to give listeners a bit of a refresh, the battle for Guadalcanal in World War II was one of the really critical battles in turning the war. The Japanese forces were defeated. They lost 24,000 soldiers, and they were considered to be invincible up till then. The US had 1,600 casualties, 4,200 wounded, and thousands that lost their lives through malaria and other diseases. There's so much at stake here. I remember during the referendum on the yes vote, the Indigenous vote for voices of parliament, a journo asked the Prime Minister what kept him up at night, and he said, the war in Ukraine. What keeps me up at night is what's going on more locally. And I remember when the security pact was signed with China in secret in 2022, after Sogavare had done what they call the switch from Taiwan to the mainland in 2019, I was literally up all night. In fact, the next morning I did a radio interview with Luke Grant on TGB, but I'd been thinking about the consequences of what was happening there. Why are they so important? If you go back to World War II and you look at that strategic environment going forward, the Solomons is potentially a critical base or naval base for China's ever-expanding maritime ambitions in the event of a war. And in World War II, it was a critical nexus between the US Navy, the US military, and Brisbane, which is 2,000 kilometres or about a two-hour flight away in terms of supply line and logistics. And if China was successful long-term in establishing a beefed-up presence there, they would arguably have the capability to interdict or prevent that logistical nexus between us in Australia and our number one ally, our security guarantor, the United States.
Yeah. That's why it's so important. So how do you think it's the elections critical. Themselves will go? And is Sogavaro there forever?
Yeah, they have. He's getting on in years. They have elections every 4 years. This one's been pushed back a year on the excuse that they ran the Pacific Games, which, of course, China funded the stadium and so on. China will have more than one horse in this race, no doubt. And, you know, they there was some, let's put it bluntly, they kind of bribed most of the cabinet to make the switch when they did so. And the governor of Malaita province, Solomon's has a population of about 750,000, about the size of the Gold Coast. The governor of Malaita province, Daniel Sridani, was booted out in a vote of no confidence a couple of years ago. And he's recently been in Washington giving his side of the story there. The Australian government, through DFAT and the Department of Defence, is spending $25 million
I've just lost you.
Support. Can you hear me, Chris?
I've just lost him. Hang on.
Okay.
What I might have to do is go to an ad break because I have no sound coming through from Andrew right now. So I'll fix that up during a commercial break and we'll come back with Andrew Phelan right here on TNT.
Sonia Paulton.
Since 2018, I have been documenting and making a documentary about the issue of transgenderism. And because the fact is, when I happened upon it around 2016, 2017, I literally could not believe what I was being told that I must believe. And that is, first and foremost, that there is some sort of anomaly of nature that enables some people to be born in the wrong body. Of that, straight off the bat, did not make any sense to me whatsoever. And then I could clearly see what was happening, that men were going into women's spaces and taking over women's spaces, such as sport, in all manner of places, in politics. And it really alarmed me. But nothing alarmed me so much as what was happening to children.
Sonia Paulton on today's News Talk, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
JDRF's vision is to create a world without type 1 diabetes. The type 1 diabetes community is at the heart of everything JDRF does. We were founded by the type 1 diabetes community. In the main, we are governed by the type 1 diabetes community, we're energised by the type 1 community, and we're accountable to the type 1 diabetes community. It's on their behalf that we exist, and it's on their behalf that we must succeed. JDRF exists to rid the world of type 1 diabetes. It's easy to say, but it's hard to do. So for us, that means rallying all the resources and all the people and all the organisations required to make that a reality as quickly as possible. The world's best researchers, exciting innovative companies, and the passion of the type 1 diabetes community, then delivered through the health system so lives get better every day, day after day, until the day we find a cure. To everybody in the type 1 diabetes community, no matter your age or stage with the disease, whether you were diagnosed recently or a long time ago, we need you to know that we are here working on your behalf to deliver a world without type 1 diabetes as quickly as we can. Thank you to everybody who supported JDRF in so many ways. You are making our vision of a world without type 1 diabetes possible.
Are we on the air?
Am I on the air?
You're on the air.
On the air 24/7. Your news talk giant, TNT.
All right. Humidity. You see, we've got big humidity going on in Sydney at the moment. And what happens is, I'll just explain to you the inside information. It actually clogs up your earpiece. Long story, but when it's very humid, little bits of condensation get into your earpiece and you can hardly hear anything. Anyway, that's the reason. So I've changed it all. We're all good. Now, Andrew Phelan, back to you, our Asian expert. I said we've all been overwhelmingly focused on wars in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, but so has China, right?
Yeah, to a much lesser extent. Their focus is on the Indo-Pacific. That's the intermediate goal, to be the regional hegemon in this region, and we're seeing friction. It's like two big tectonic plates, two continental plates banging against each other. The China plate, you could put North Korea and Russia's eastern part in that bucket versus the rest, which is the US-led coalition of US, Japan, increasingly the Philippines, Vietnam. There's talk of Japan joining AUKUS, which I would welcome. New Zealand certainly changed its tune under the new prime minister, etc. Right now, the flashpoint between those two tectonic plates is probably the Taiwan Strait and increasingly the southern part of the South China Sea, where the Philippines is continually trying to resupply a World War II-era wreck that sunk on a reef at Second Thomas Shoal. And China's been preventing the Philippine Navy from resupplying the sailors that sit on that rusting hulk on the top of a reef because...
So how are they preventing them doing that?
Well, in two ways. They're using their so-called Coast Guard. It's Coast Guard in name, if not by nature. These vessels are the size of destroyers and equipped as such. And they're using water cannons to... which is a form of, you could argue, grey zone war activity or non-lethal weaponry, although they can be lethal, to literally go up to the Philippine Coast Guard and blast the crew off their feet. And some Philippine personnel have been injured. It's not dissimilar to the use of sonar against our Navy divers in Japan's territorial waters. And this is very much in, the key point here, Chris, is this is very much in what is recognized as the Philippines' territorial waters. It's exclusive economic zone, which is 200 nautical miles from the coast of Palawan. It's a long, long way from the south coast of China, which is China's nearest coastal area. So these frictions continue to play out. We'll watch the elections in the Solomon Islands tomorrow. It's going to take a few weeks for the results to come in because logistically it's a huge challenge. There's a lot of islands. You know, the Solomons covers 2,900 square kilometers of ocean area. And sometimes we think about these little dots in the Pacific and say, you know, so what? They're not that important. They're not that significant. But China has an ambition for a big blue water navy. And there's a lot of big blue Pacific out there. And these little island nations, their exclusive economic zones are often 20 times or more the size of the territory itself. To give you an idea, Micronesia's exclusive economic zone is about the size of India. So strategically, they're very important. Yeah. So there's a lot at stake for Australia. As I mentioned, we're spending $25 million. We're sending some election observers, some current former MPs out to make sure that everything is over and above board. So we'll have to see. A lot at stake for Australia.
Yeah, very true. Australia-China, the ties seem to be a lot different under Anthony Albanese, certainly stronger. I guess they were always going to be, given how foul they were under the previous government. We had that recent visit to Canberra by the Foreign Minister, Wang Yi. Paul Keating played, a larger part than the Prime Minister, and I doubt whether Albo was too impressed by that. Now we've got Premier Li Qiang coming soon. What do you make of relations with China, between Australia and China now?
Well, I think the operative word in your introduction there, Chris, was seem to be better. I don't think they're better. I think you've got to look at China's grand strategy, its long-term strategic intent. And looking at the mainstream media, and I don't want to sound too critical, but the mainstream media are not terribly Asia literate. I've read a couple of articles on Australia-China relations lately where they refer to, for example, Minister for Trade, Minister Ren Hong Bin. I've read a couple of articles where he's referred to as Mr. Hong Bin. And of course, in Chinese, the surname comes first and the given names come second. So he should be called Mr. Ren instead of Mr. Hong Bin. But I've seen that error a few times from mainstream journalists. And I think we're going to touch on the Singapore transition of power later. But similarly, when the last time Lee Hsien Loong, the outgoing Prime Minister, was here, Prime Minister Albanese thanked him and his wife, Mrs. Lee. That's all very well, but his wife's name is not Mrs. Lee. Her name's Ho Ching, and she's one of the most powerful women in the world, because in Chinese culture, the wife does not take the surname of her husband.
Well, so maybe mainstream media, especially in Australia, needs to get a few Chinese linguists in and do a few lessons.
I think it's, if you look at our body politic, I think other than Ted O'Brien, the opposition energy minister, I don't think anyone has commercial experience in Asia or with China. Malcolm Turnbull did, a former prime minister, and that stood him in good stead. But it's an issue in our body politic. It's an issue in our media. And, you know, since I've come back to Australia, that's the kind of lost cause that I'm trying to kind of champion with your help, Chris.
Yes.
But China's certainly got a finger in a lot of pies. It's taken the Hamas-Palestinian side in that conflict, and it continues to support its, they call it the No Limits Partnership with Russia via weapons shipments, because, of course, we're talking the Eurasian landmass between the Russian Far East and Central Russia or Moscow, and they're connected by rail. So there's no way that the U.S. or any other outside authority can come in and audit what the cargo that's being transported between those two countries across the Eurasian landmass. But there are other ways of trying to see if that's going on, and it certainly is. So, you know, Russia, it's interesting. I'm back to relations with Australia. Vicky Shu, who's, you know, been harassed by the Communist Party for the work that she's done in Australia, she wrote a great piece in the Saturday paper a couple of weeks ago, and she said, with reference to Wang Yi's visit, she said, one could say, and I quote, one could say wherever Wang passed, Australia was remodeled into China for him. It's a very well put sentence, because the meeting with the business community was off limits to Australian press, but China state media were allowed in. And similarly, the meeting with Keating really, I'd love to meet him and debate him on this. I used to have him up on a bit of a pedestal. I worked at the Shanghai Fosters joint venture where he laid the, foundation stone. I was in Tiananmen Square when he was at the Great Hall of the People. You know, I read his, I have an autographed copy of his book, Engagement Australia Faces the Asia Pacific. So back in the day, we really held him in high regard. I also had an APEC card, thanks to that organization, which enabled me to travel visa free to countries like China and Vietnam. But
he's got blinkers on when it comes to China.
I don't know where he's getting his intel from. I think he's living in his own little bubble, because he certainly doesn't seem to be up to speed with what's going on. And so similarly, we had a trade delegation here the other day, and Christine Holgate, former head of AusPost, now head of another logistics firm that does a fair bit of stuff with Alibaba. She's standing up and saying, well, you know, Australia needs to work on closer relations with China. We need to have closer relations with China. I don't think that's really her place as the head of a logistics business to be saying that. She's not the foreign minister. I don't know what her China background is. But China's e-commerce capability is growing massively. We saw Temu, the Chinese e-commerce platform that is on the NASDAQ. It's got a market cap of $100 billion. They bought two ads in the Super Bowl final for $7 million US dollars each. And if you haven't heard of Temu now, you will, especially if you've got kids. But I get
flooded and bombarded by their emails. They keep badgering me.
There you go. So I understand it's in, parcel companies interest to have, you know, closer ties with China. But I think these so-called business leaders need to be a bit more aware of the overall picture and the national interest.
Yeah, very true. Finally, what are your thoughts on the transition to Singapore's fourth prime minister since independence? What Lawrence Wong takes over next month, Andrew. Where would
correct?
Where would China stand on Wong's elevation, or does it even matter?
Yeah. Well, it absolutely matters, and it's critical for Australia. And, you know, in my 15 years in Southeast Asia, I was based in Singapore, and Singapore was very kind to me, and I'm very appreciative for the time that I had there. It's an extremely well-run city-state of 5 or 6 million. And I always liked Lee Hsien Loong, the current prime minister, the outgoing prime minister. And he's had this is a very smooth transition of power to the incoming prime minister, Lawrence Wong, who comes from pretty humble background. You know, his dad was a sales rep. His mum was a primary school teacher. He was raised in the Methodist Christian tradition. And he lived in public housing, like 80% of Singaporeans in the HDB flats. He's a US university educated. His ethnic background is from Hainan Island in the south of China, but he did his undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, did a master's in economics at the University of Michigan, great school, and a master of public administration from Harvard. So his apprenticeship has been long. He was a public servant before he became a politician. And he's held several portfolios, most recently Minister of Finance, Deputy Prime Minister, etc. Interestingly, he chaired Singapore's committee on COVID. And just by way of example, lessons that Australia can learn from quality governance in Singapore. Prior to COVID, Singapore had a, you know, Chris, in Australia, we have the bushfire danger system, right? Total fire ban. And you see those signs as you drive around. Well, Singapore, before COVID, due to their experience with SARS and MERS, had a thing called the DORSCON system, or the Disease Outbreak Response System condition. That was up and running before we heard of COVID. And fortuitously, the opposition leader at the time, I've heard him speak personally, was an expert on flu viruses. But they prepare ahead. You know, I used to work opposite the Ministry of Development, and you'd walk across the street and they had a scale model of the whole of Singapore, and they're thinking 50 years ahead. And just on the point of social cohesion from your previous content that you were talking about, you know, Singapore is very careful about race relations and religious relations within the Island Republic, and it's not tolerated to go and sort of tear that fabric. There was a case, I think about 2016, of an imam from India who, in his sermon in a mosque, started having a go at Christians and Jews. Well, have a guess what happened to him. I'll tell you, he broke the law, and he was prosecuted, and he had to pay a fine. He had to publicly apologize. Wow. And then he was deported from Singapore back to India. And similarly, at the moment, there's a case a transport minister in Singapore. There's about 30 odd charges against him, and they're things like accepting tickets to the Singapore Formula One Grand Prix, accepting tickets to Premier League games, soccer games in the UK. This is not tolerated, and from what I've seen of Lawrence Wong so far, he's very impressive, and I've had a bit to do with Singapore government, Gan Yom King, the previous health minister. They're understated, they're modest, they're very well equipped, they're very effective. I think there are lessons learned, but Lawrence Wong said, you know, it's part of our compact with the people that the People's Action Party do not tolerate corruption, and right. Singapore politicians are very highly paid in order to take that temptation away. A lot we can learn.
Don't throw your chewing gum on the ground. Don't spit, and don't go to the football on someone else's tab. I've got it. I'll keep that in mind. Andrew Phelan, fabulous analysis. Thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Good on you, Asian expert Andrew Phelan. Interesting. Isn't that very typical of Singapore, where everything has got to be done by the book? And that's the way they run their country. We've got to respect the way they run their country. Not necessarily as free as others, but at the same time, it gives them the international reputation that they do have. I've got some news that I do want to tell you about, a little bit from Israel that I'll get to you in just a short moment. And then we'll talk to Di McDonald, who's a stalking victim and someone who's got a lot to say about the experiences at Bondi Junction on Saturday afternoon. We will take a break for news right here on TNT.
Here's the news.
TNT Radio News.
Good TNT, this is James O'Neill. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu canceled planned retaliatory strikes against Iran following a phone conversation with U.S. President Joe Biden. President Joe Biden has called on congressional leaders to expedite the passage of a $95 billion foreign aid package aimed at supporting Israel and Ukraine through the House of Representatives. The FBI has initiated a criminal investigation into the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, which resulted in the deaths of six construction workers last month.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Couple of bits and pieces that I thought you'd be interested in. The Morgan poll comes out on a regular basis, and I always get press releases about the Morgan poll, but this is really interesting. For the second time in a row, the Morgan poll is showing that on that crucial two-party preferred vote, the surveys that they have done on two consecutive occasions now are indicating that the coalition is head of Labor. There's a swing to the coalition continuing on a two-party preferred basis. The Liberal Party, National Party coalition is standing at 51% as far as their latest published poll is concerned, and this was published only about 10 minutes ago. And the ALP is sitting on 49%. Now, that's only a 2% difference, but given the fact that it's two-party preferred and it's happened two consecutive surveys, this spells trouble for Labor unless they can turn it around. That would be a win to the coalition today if an election were held. Two surveys in a row from Morgan finding the coalition leading the Labor Party 51% to 49% in that crucial area, that crucial two-party preferred basis. Thank you to Alex for passing that on to me. And then the other bit I do want to tell you about is coming out of AP News, and it concerns the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military has renewed warnings today for Palestinians not to return to northern Gaza a day after witnesses and medical officials said Israeli troops opened fire and killed five people among throngs of displaced residents trying to walk back to their homes in the devastated area. This is why the Israeli government right now and the IDF are winning no friends in the international community, because they are picking on innocents. Okay, they've said you can't go back to northern Israel, you can't go back to northern Gaza, but at the same time, when displaced residents attempt to do that, there's no picking them up, there's no warning them, there's no putting them in the back of a truck and ferrying them back to southern Gaza. They've shot them dead. They've opened fire and killed five people, according to witnesses and medical officials who were present. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were driven from the north after Israeli forces first launched their offensive. You'll remember that soon after October 7. And so after this many months, 5 months, many of them just want to go back to their homes, whether their homes are devastated or in pieces or not. They want to go back, and they've walked back. And they're being shot dead. That comes from AP at the moment. Let's move on to something entirely different and something closer to home, if I may. Stalking is a crime. And according to the Victorian Law Reform Commission, it affects at least one in six women. And would you believe one in 15 men? But one in six women. I speak with some authority on stalking. I have written a non-fiction book and had it published about 15 years ago on stalking. And to say that Australia is underprepared to combat stalking is an understatement. My next guest will discuss her horrific case of being stalked. Di McDonald has become Australia's leading advocate for stalking victims. after she was featured on the ABC television's Australian Story. You may have seen it. She continues to do this work, even though her stalker, former boyfriend Max Gardner, is now out of prison. Di McDonald joins me now. Welcome to TNT, Di.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Let's get down to the facts of the matter. Max Gardner was convicted twice for stalking.
That's correct.
Just give us a little bit of an insight on how the relationship started and how soon did it go awfully toxic?
Okay, so it started in October of 2014, and by December of 2014, it was extremely toxic. Now, I met him at work. I didn't meet him on a dating app or anything like that, although he is everywhere on those. So I then...
You had a chance to check him out, so to speak, because he was in the same workplace.
Well, he was a customer and I was a supervisor.
Right.
So he came in the store looking for a particular item, which we'd actually sold out of. So he came back in and thanked me for my service and asked me out for coffee, which I declined initially. But he kept coming in and he won over everyone I worked with. And literally we were just going for coffee right out front of work. So safe. Few more coffees, and then we started going out for dinner and then going to see live music. By Christmas, so December, Boxing Day, it was all done and dusted. He was so jealous of my son. Now, my son lives 3 hours away from me. I don't see him all the time. So, yeah, broke up with him. And then a few weeks later, he turned up at a friend's gig in Elwood and apologized profusely. So, yeah, I did eventually take him back. And by May, it was done and dusted for good. And that's when it all started to go pear-shaped.
And when did you, how bad did it get, which prompted you to seek help? How bad did it get?
He was coming over to my home all the time, like knocking on the door. Now, I didn't have an intervention order or anything like that at that point. He was coming into work, giving me letters, apologizing, please take me back, blah, blah, blah. It got too much. And then because I was ignoring him and everything, he was going to center management, complaining about me. They were coming into work, you know, Di, get rid of this guy. Whatever's going on, just get rid of him. So I had no choice but to go to police. They actually advised me to tell him, like text him to say, I'm going to police and the courts if you do not stop. Now, he texted back that he would leave me alone. But that wasn't the case. So did eventually go to the courts early June of 2015 and was given an interim order. And then you go back a month later and he has a right to say, no, I don't want this against me. I'll leave her alone. But what he had started doing was putting up flyers at the two venues I would go to on a regular basis. So I picked up one of the flyers the night before court and took that in. So the magistrate actually believed me over him.
So describe for me what flyers he was putting up. What did they look like? What did they say?
What did they say? Excuse me. They were offering my services to men to come in and buy me a drink and, yeah.
And a photo of you on the flyers?
Yes.
Wow. Yes. So you took that in. What did police do when they saw the flyer?
They didn't do much of anything for a very, very long time.
Right.
And even in 2017, we're talking 2 years into it now, I had video footage and everything, but he was wearing a balaclava. And they knew it was him. They could tell by his gait, his walk, because he'd had back surgery. Mm-hmm. So they knew it was him. And because he was wearing a balaclava, they said, no magistrate will convict him. So they didn't pursue anything.
Dear, oh dear.
Yes.
Okay. So today he is out of prison?
Yes. So what happened in 2018, he went after my youngest daughter. He went to jail for her in 2018.
Right.
That's when I got a detective assigned to me. But it took him going after my child And then another 2 years after that, so 2020, he went to jail for what he did to me. And it actually took the FBI getting involved, a linguist by the name of James R. Fitzgerald, and he's one of the pioneers of linguistics. He has his own Netflix series called Manhunt Unabomber.
Yep.
Yeah, so he got involved in my case as well and brought the closure to it all.
How did he do that?
Well, with all the letters that Max was giving me at work, you know, begging me to take him back, and with the flyers he was putting up at the venues, and then also court documents that he was submitting, Jim tied them all together to say that one person wrote all of these.
Right.
Everyone has their own particular writing style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he's out of prison now. And what I was trying to get to is, when was the last contact he made toward you?
Oh, it's been since he was in prison.
Right.
Yeah.
So about 4 years.
That I can honestly say that I can prove. Yeah.
We'll put 4 years.
Yes.
Are you suggesting that he's tried to contact you since?
Yeah, but I can't say too much about that.
Okay.
Yeah. So
you can't prove it.
Exactly. So 2021, he was released from prison. And after he was released, he was on a 2-year corrections order. So that finished in January of 23. And it has been quiet.
Right.
Yes.
Your childhood friend, Karen Chakuti, was murdered at the age of 49. And Max, in his stalking of you, discovered this fact. His subsequent behaviour was related to that. Is that what? Why did that play a role?
That played a role because I got together with some school friends. So Karen went to school with my sister.
Uh huh.
So we formed a little bit of a committee and decided to do a fundraiser for Karen's children. And we did a story in the Herald Sun. So that's how he became aware of what I was doing. So he lined, what we did, we met at our high school and then we walked to a pub called the Burval, and that's where the fundraiser was. We had an auction, we had live music that was going all day and night. So he lined the streets of the walk that we did from our high school to the pub with flyers using the photo out of the Herald Sun.
Right.
Yeah. So it was basically just defaming me, what a bad mother I am and whatever.
Okay.
Cheated on my husband, all this rubbish, which is not true.
All right. In recent weeks, I've spoken to the murdered Melbourne girl, Celeste Manno, her mother.
Yes, I know.
And her mother has been talking to me, as has Renee Heath, the MP, Liberal MP in the Upper House. They have both been speaking to me quite vocally about the fact that there are a set of stalking recommendations from that review that was done sitting on the desk of the Labor, Victorian Labor government, and nothing is being done about them. That must disgust you.
It is. It really does, because 7 of those recommendations are mine. I put forward to the VLRC a 9,000-word submission. And they took on board my recommendations, which I was very grateful that they listened, but they are sitting there doing nothing. Apparently, the trial is in stage 2. Stage 1 was 2 police stations to be trained in the SASH tool.
Mm-hmm.
Stage 2, they've added Geelong as a 3rd police station. That's all I can gather is stage 2. So the SASH tool is basically just questions that police officers can ask a victim when they first go in. So there's 13 questions attached to the SASH tool. Now, I could have answered each and every one of those questions with multiple examples of what was happening to me. But still,
they're not interested, are they?
No, they're not. They're not.
Mm.
No.
Celeste Menno's mother says the same thing. Renee Heath says the same thing to me just about every second week, and now you're telling me the same thing.
Thank you.
I would have thought the Victorian Labor government should be ashamed of itself for not acting on behalf of women who are scared to death.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. You are in fear of your life, He actually was charged with threats against my life, and he got a good behaviour bond.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. He deserved it. Not. No. I want to take a quick break. He didn't deserve it. I wanted to take a quick break, and I want to talk to you about Bondi just briefly while I've got you, but I do have to go to a break. I'll come back, Di McDonald, in just a second, right here on TNT.
The challenges our planet's animals are facing sometimes feel a bit heavy.
The animals haven't eaten in a day, 2 days. They haven't drank anything. They're cold, they're dehydrated.
As soon as we started our descent, everywhere I could see was mud, just absolutely mud.
So the country has been in prolonged drought so long, it was like a tinderbox waiting to go up.
Okay, very heavy. Each of us wants to be part of the solution, and we can be. Remember that there's good happening right now. At home.
All right, we were able to get into your unit, and we have all four of your cats. So,
okay.
And around the world. For any animal in any disaster. So let's focus on that, right? Be part of the solution, one rescue at a time. Search ifa.org/disaster ready.
We are for pets. We do anything for them because they do everything for us. We are for people, for those who love pets unconditionally. We are for good, from adoptions and veterinary care to disaster relief and fighting pet hunger. We stand together to create a better world for pets and families in need. We are PetSmart Charities, for pets, for people, for good.
Thanks for listening and being a part of the Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Di McDonald, just off the back of Bondi Junction, you've noticed that the majority of the victims were women, the vast majority. The vast majority of survivors are women.
Yeah.
This fellow obviously targeted women, and the guys just got in the way. What should we do? It's hard to predict something like that in a shopping center like Bondi Junction. It's hard to prevent it. Let's be serious.
Yeah.
But should we equip women to carry pepper spray, for instance, and allow them to do so?
I would be all for that. I'm one of the luckier ones with, I have like a security watch. So this watch here.
Yeah.
It goes out to 5 family and friends if I'm in trouble. So it's virtually a phone. You can text. It records what is happening to me.
Right.
You know, I'm one of the lucky ones, but I would also carry pepper spray because you need more than just walking through a car park with your key between your fingers or something like that.
Yeah.
I would, yeah, really value being able to carry, you know, just a small thing of pepper spray in case you need it.
Yeah.
It's just a what if. Yeah.
Yeah. I gave one to my daughter once because she was traveling and she was 18. And I don't regret doing it. As I understand it, it's against the law to use something like that as a weapon.
Yeah.
But the law's got to be changed. You know, the last 18 months, the statistics on women being killed in domestic violence situations alone have been just horrendous.
It has. It's getting worse. And I don't understand. I don't think I'll ever understand why. You know, just if it's not working out, divorce them. Or if they break up with you, get over it.
Mm.
There's no need for revenge. So with the MPs that I'm working with in Melbourne, we're implementing Stalking Awareness Day, which will be on the 24th of May.
That's so great.
We had launch day at Parliament on the 7th of March. So, yeah, we just need to get the word out about Stalking Awareness Day. There's a website, so it's www.sada.au, so Stalking Awareness Day Australia. And it's an information tool that people who are being stalked can go and have a look at and go to the booklet and find out where they can go and get help and what help is actually available to them when you don't have help from police.
Yeah. We need help from government though now, don't we? Especially in Victoria.
Yeah. Especially. Yeah. Yes. We need that stalking reform implemented yesterday.
Yes, exactly. Let's talk on or around May the 24th about this, because it's an important issue that needs to be covered. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Good on you. Appreciate your time. Di McDonald is her name. You may have seen her on The Australian Story. I didn't see it live, but I've since seen the program. A horrific experience, and looking around for someone to help you was not easy. Let's go to our talkback lines. We've only got a few minutes before the end of the program. Where did that program go? Sonia Poulton coming up after the news too, by the way. Let's now go to Siv, who's on our talkback lines. Hi, Siv.
G'day, Luke, and I'm a huge fan of Sonia Poulton. I do hope she hears that. I'm a huge fan
Did you just call me Luke?
No, call you Luke. Sorry.
Listen here, Barry. You get your names right.
Simon, did I call you Luke? No, sorry, mate. I had a Siv moment. Chris, there you are. Fred.
you could have called me a lot worse, so that's okay.
That's all right. I didn't mean to call you that, Steve. Anyway, we've got to have a bit of a laugh, eh? We've got to have a bit of levity.
Oh, it'd be good if we could find a reason to.
Tell you what. By the way, just briefly on that last story, you can have as many days against domestic violence. You can wear as many white ribbons as you possibly can. But if your sentencing regime is pitiful, and if your first consideration is the rights of the perpetrator and the background of said perpetrator, then you're going to do nothing to help victims.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. So if you've got a judiciary that sees it that way, and you've got an academic class that sees it that way, then you're going to do nothing to help perpetrators. So unfortunately for that last guest, she's not going to get help until such time as the sentencing regime actually reflects the seriousness of the crime. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated in that police seem to be unable to work out what they should be doing in the first instance.
Well, that's right. And then that side has to be made simple too. But I tell you, if you can't treat criminals as they're meant to be treated, if you can't do any of that, then you're not going to get anywhere. Now, just briefly onto this supermarket inquiry, I was going to talk a bit about that. There's a lot of theatre and bluster and all this stuff going on. This is the Australian inquiry into these big supermarkets to find out, you know, how come we're paying a whole lot for a whole lot of things, just to summarise it. Nick McKim, the Green Centre, now I don't know his background, so I don't want to whack him up entirely. I know that a lot of people in politics don't have much business acumen, so it's kind of useless them fronting an inquiry, questioning a chief executive in any real meaningful way. But, you know, again, this is going to do nothing for your grocery prices, folks. No. Nothing. It's going to produce theatre. It's going to produce something for the TV cameras.
Yep.
But it's going to do nothing for your grocery prices, Chris.
Yep. You're exactly right. I wish I could comment on what you've just said, but you've just nailed it. And sadly, that's the truth. And one of the reasons is, as Mark Latham pointed out beforehand, and he has honours in economics at Sydney University, and he just says we just don't have the competition that we need to see prices fall.
Correct. Now, I'm going to go and actually write your name down a couple of times, Fred. Chris, and I'll talk to you again at some time in the future, mate.
Good to hear from you. Thank you, mate. Siv, there you go. Our regular caller, but a fellow who's got his head screwed on. We like to hear what he has to say about events of the day or the week. I've almost run out of time. I do want to tell you about this, though. This has come from a press release about the New South Wales Art Gallery. We are excited to announce new names for the two buildings that comprise the Art Museum. New names. You thought they were just called the New South Wales Art Gallery, right? No, they've got new names, Indigenous names. The new Art Gallery, the centrepiece of Sydney Modern Project, has been given the Aboriginal name Nala Badu, meaning seeing waters in the Sydney language. In Nala Badu, overlooking Sydney Harbour on the land of the Gadigal, visitors are first welcomed to the gallery devoted to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists. But one thing occurred to me. There are 130 different dialects of indigenous language. This is only one of them. I love how they've done it, and they've called it Nalu Badu. Fantastic. But only for Gadigal speaking people. What about all the other 129 other languages? There you go. Don't call it the art gallery. It's called Nala Badu. Welcome to the new world. I've got to get out of here. Sonia Poulton is up next. We'll do it at the same time tomorrow. This is Chris Smith on TNT.